Broadcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602. Or toll-free across the United States, it's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
Open phones this afternoon on The Dividing Line, 877-753-3341, 877-753-3341. We've had a number of folks who've called in. We had someone who called in last week and then dropped off right as I was about to go to them. And had a couple other people who've called in with various questions, and since we were talking about other things, or they got scared to death because I was melting down because I was reading absurd stuff on the internet, whatever the reasons were, or because I was playing a section of something, you know, whatever. Now's your opportunity to call in. 877-753-3341 is the phone number there. I've been investing a fair amount of time in the blog of late. There have been some very interesting, at least I think very interesting, discussions there concerning Islam. There is a lot of stuff appearing on the web now, not only the stuff concerning issues regarding the Muslim, well, the situation in New Jersey. Whatever that situation was, we don't know yet, but the situation there with the murders of the family, the Coptic Christian family, and the responses, at the very least, the responses of many that have been documented on the internet to that those murders tells you a lot about the religion of peace, anyways, as people rather ironically identify it. And so there's a lot of stuff out there if you know where to look, and eventually, even I'm smart enough to figure that out. Most folks find it a whole lot faster. And then we had Omar Bakri Muhammad's material that I posted yesterday. Islam is the final revelation. Therefore, those believing in it submit to Allah, the only one worthy of obedience in every sphere of life. To understand 9/11, we must go back to Tawhid, the exclusive worship of God in every sphere, religious, political, social, etc. Every human action must relate to this. 9/11 was undoubtedly an unpleasant moment for its targets or their relatives. Talk about an understatement. Unpleasant moment. Muslims and non-Muslims, but those committing it acted as a result of the predestined divine decree, although God does give man free will. okay, whatever in the world that means. But it's a lot of stuff out there if you know where to look, and sometimes you don't really want to look, but it is available. So all sorts of stuff. Obviously, I recognize that people who defend some of the positions that I address on the blog or in writing or on the program, I recognize that you may not want to expose yourself to calling into this radio program. I do not necessarily call into very many radio programs myself. The simple fact that the person on their end has their finger on the button. By the way, I don't. I think I'm actually going to have that capability in the not too distant future, if the equipment sitting over on those books over there is any indication. But up to this point in time, I have not had a button that I could use to cut somebody off, even if I wanted to. That's somebody else's job. I'm just sitting here with a computer in front of me and a microphone, and we just go from there. But if you happen to believe that I have gone over the deep end in responding to Dave Hunt, I'd like to hear from you. I'd like to hear someone defend what Dave Hunt has done in refusing to take responsibility for his own actions, in refusing to take responsibility for his errors, his documented, gross, repeated errors of ignorance. I'd like to hear someone say, you know what, there isn't any higher standard for a Christian. There is no higher standard for someone who is involved in Christian apologetics. And therefore, you should cut him a break. He's a nice elderly man, and he tells nice stories, and we should all just be nice to Dave. And let Dave do whatever Dave wants to do. Dave can publish all the books he wants, and he can make stuff up and use the most absurd argumentation on the planet, but it's okay. Because once it's documented that he's wrong, we just misunderstood him. When he said that Spurgeon unequivocally denied limited atonement, he didn't mean unequivocally. He meant unequivocally in the sense of equivocally, see. And that should have been obvious to all of us. And when he said that the best translation of Acts 13:48 was disposed themselves, and that's what the New World Translation says, and that's the only committee, if you can call it a committee, translated, published English translation I know of that uses that as its main translation of the text, he didn't mean to use the NWT, he just didn't know what the NWT said, and okay, so he doesn't actually translate Greek, so he couldn't really say it's the best one, but, you know, look, it's Dave. We can just let Dave do that. That's okay. And when he makes up mythical Hebrew texts based upon mythical references in the Dead Sea Scroll and Dead Sea Scrolls and mythical early church fathers and mythical translations by mythical scholars that ends up with a mythical translation that just happens to be contrary to what the text actually means, it's okay because he didn't mean it seriously. Anyways, he was just suggesting that for further study. See, so we just need to have a different standard because Dave's Dave. And so if you'd like to defend that perspective, the phone lines are open. Now's your opportunity. 877-753-3341. We had a King James-only advocate come into channel, and we tried reasoning with him some. And he first was asking, it's sort of like you know how, for example, the locust has a certain number of year cycle? Well, it seems that Dan Corner has like a 2-year cycle. And like every 2 years, all of a sudden he pops his head out of the ground and spits at a few people and then disappears for a while. And so we had a King James only guy come into channel and say, hey, I hear that James White won't debate Dan Corner. It's like, oh. www.aomn.org/capitalOSAS.html. I should just have a pop-up that just says that as soon as Dan Corner's name appears anywhere. And there's a file that you can listen to over at Straight Gate where I go through all of this stuff and document it all. And it's very, very complete. But anyway, he, of course, as a King James only advocate, was likewise very anti-reformed. And as we tried to talk with him, things got warmer and warmer. And finally, the second day, you know, he just lost it and got himself kick-banned. And so he started coming in, trying to break the ban. And that White runs a tight ship on his radio program because he doesn't want anyone to expose his lies. I'd challenge that King James only advocate to give us a call. Let's find out. Let's see if that's really the case. Because like I said, I don't have a button here. That's somebody else's job. And obviously you start getting nasty or something. Somebody will take care of you. But that's not something I do. I could actually use a little more volume because I sort of disappear every once in a while. I just go boop and I'm gone. And I think it's because I'm right at the edge of the suppressor, compressor, tongue depressor thing, whatever it is. Whatever it is that we've got over there. I got all this rack of electronic equipment stuff, and I keep getting told that the newest thing, that this will make it sound really, really good, and then the newest thing is going to make it sound even better, and pretty soon I should sound like Pavarotti or something. So that would make people unhappy. Oh, and before I start going to our phone calls, they're just flooding in. Actually, we have one. Got plenty of lines open. Before we go to our phone calls, this weekend, tomorrow, in fact, I head out to North Carolina. And I honestly I'm not completely zeroed in on exactly where I am. I know I'm in Rocky Mount, At least that's where I'm speaking. But I'm not exactly sure where I'm staying. I know where I'm flying into, and there's just, I don't know about all that stuff. But anyway, on Saturday afternoon, I'm going to be addressing the Da Vinci Code stuff. And I was putting together a PowerPoint on it yesterday, and I realized I would have to spend, what did I figure out that it was? I had less than 2 minutes per slide in the time frame allotted, and that ain't going to work. Believe me, I'm going to go way over on that. But anyway, we have the Da Vinci Code and the Emergent Church Movement on Saturday afternoon, and then I'm doing all the services on Sunday at Grace Reformed Baptist Church in Rocky Mount, and we'll be seeing you folks there, hopefully. And look forward to that. And then I'm actually getting a chance after that to do an interview with the folks who did the, a lot of you have heard of, I haven't gotten it yet, but there is a DVD out on the history of Calvinism that everyone's raving about. And the folks who put that together are putting together another one now on apologetics. And I'll be meeting with them on Monday morning back there to do a interview. Who knows whether it'll be worth having in the DVD or not, but that's what we're going to be doing. So a little visit to the cooler climes back in North Carolina over this weekend. If you're in that area, we would look forward to seeing you either on Saturday afternoon or in the Sunday services there in Rocky Mount. And please do not ask me where it is. I haven't a clue. Once I get off the plane in Raleigh, someone's driving me from there, and that's pretty much it. So at least I hope that's what's going to happen. I just realized, there's something about a rental car, but hopefully I'm not going to have to drive someplace because I have no idea where in the world I would be going. That would be rather intriguing. I'm sort of watching the channel here for a moment just simply because last week that's when all the stuff appeared, and we ended up completely changing the direction of where we were going last week. And if we don't get too many phone calls, I may go ahead and go back and pick up the clip that we were playing. In fact, I'll fire up my program here and load that one up just in case we end up going back to that one. We will we'll see when we get there. 877-753-3341. Let's go ahead and start clearing the board, and let's talk with Adam. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Hi, Dr. White. I met you down in Peoria, and it was really nice to hear you speak. A lot of people were really impressed.
Oh, over the Reformation Sunday weekend. Mm-hmm.
And I was the one that asked you about Luther, and I told you I was doing a paper, and I got a really good grade on it, so I wanted to thank you for your help.
Oh, good.
And I wanted to tell you that I heard your program with Chuck Christmeyer, and I thought it was going to be disastrous when I heard the program that he did with Dave Hunt, and they were putting forth some really bad arguments. And I said, it's going to be disastrous when James gets on, because he's just going to blow this stuff out of the water. And I seriously, it felt like Chuck Christmeyer didn't know what he was talking about.
Well, now let me ask you, Chuck did a program with Dave alone.
Right.
Yeah, I did not. I'm going to have to go back through the archives and grab that one, because my understanding of this program was going to be on. We were going to discuss specifically the perseverance of the saints, and we ended up just going back to the subject of Calvinism as a whole. We had sent in the Potter's Freedom, and unfortunately, he did not have the opportunity of reading it. And so that didn't really help too much, because I had to, had to constantly be saying, nope, that's not what we believe either. And that's another misapprehension. And just had to keep going over that and over that again, again, again. And that's, a little bit on the.
Tedious?
Well.
Repetitive?
Yeah, some of those.
Well, anyways, I had a question about Lutheranism and the means of grace, because it's really weird. The section of Lutheranism that my school belongs to believes in total depravity, but they don't believe in limited atonement.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they use are what are called the means of grace. And they say that Christ can die for the whole world. He can give the salvation, but that salvation can only be applied through the means of grace, through what they believe the word and baptism, of course, is, mm-hmm. are the two main ones. And that can be strengthened through the Lord's Supper. But they would say that Christ died for the whole world, and he has their salvation in his hands, and it is given to them through these pipelines called the means of grace. And I wanted to know, what do you think would be the strongest response to that type of perspective?
Well, yeah, there's all sorts of different perspectives within Lutheranism, and there is clearly a what we would call a sacramental perspective on the means by which grace is communicated through the sacraments. And the means of grace is a term that Reformed Baptists use, but when we refer to the means of grace, we're talking about those things that God has ordained that through the church, through the preaching of the word, we would include both the Lord's Supper and baptism, the teaching of the word, the fellowship of the saints, all of those things as quote-unquote means of grace. But where we disagree is the idea of almost an ex opera operato form of sacramentalism, where you have the idea that by the mere action of the sacrament, grace is communicated. And certainly when you come to the issue of salvation itself, there would be no way that I'm speaking as a Reformed Baptist here, would use the term means of grace to refer to the grace of salvation being communicated in a sacramental fashion through baptism, the Lord's Supper, or things like that. And so I don't know anyone, quite honestly, who really I don't think it's possible, let me put it this way, I don't think it's possible for anyone to actually present a consistent viewpoint of what Luther taught, because Luther's teachings changed over time. His emphases changed over time, and the context in which he was in changed over time, and obviously what motivated him before 1525 became less important than what motivated him after 1525, which, if you're not familiar with this history, is the Peasants' Revolt. And it seems right to me that he was very, very deeply impacted by that. The Zwickau Prophets, likewise, resulted in a major shift in the directions he was going at that point in time. And so, you know, unfortunately, I think different strands of Lutheranism, not only due to the impact of Philip Melanchthon, but even going back to Luther himself, I think different strands of Lutheranism emphasize different elements, and as a result, you have, you know, some fairly major differences between monergistic Lutherans and synergistic Lutherans, and you have very anti-Calvinistic Lutherans, and then you have other Lutherans that are not nearly as anti-Calvinistic as the other strand are. And so all sorts of different perspectives that are represented there. So clearly, from the Lutheran viewpoint, the idea of particular redemption is I don't know of any Lutherans, honestly. I could be wrong about this, because I've actually read a few statements from Luther that seemed to actually have a limiting effect upon the scope of the atonement.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, you can find those, but I don't see that as having really communicated much with most of the strands of Lutheranism itself. And so you do have, you know, just a very different perspective at that point, because of the sacramentology and the viewpoint that comes from Luther on those issues. And so we come from a different perspective at that point. Lutherans tend to think that they like to say that Lutheran theology is focused upon Christ, while Calvinistic theology, both whether it be Presbyterian or that which I would hold, is focused upon the sovereignty of God. And I don't think that that's an accurate statement. I don't think you can chop things up like that. Certainly the freedom of God and salvation is central to Reformed theology, as in Calvinistic theology. But you know, that's an area of, there's a lot of discussion in regards to Lutheranism, and obviously I don't believe that, because because I believe in the union of the elect with Christ, and this has been an issue that we've been discussing on the blog, and I would refer folks to John Murray's book, Redemption Accomplished and Applied, to the chapter on union with Christ, because I believe in substitutionary atonement and that the elect were joined to Christ in his death, so that his death and resurrection is their death and resurrection, and that that is a union that Christ was aware of, and it was purposeful in his death. I believe Christ knew the identity of the elect in his death, and he died specifically in their place. That part doesn't seem to be there in Lutheranism, and hence the whole view that we would have of the atonement at that point, and the idea of a hypothetical atonement over against purposeful atonement. That's where we would part paths at that particular point.
Well, Sarg is confusing because I was talking to a Lutheran. He said that we believe that he died substitutionarily for everybody, but he holds that atonement in his hands until it's given out to the means of grace. I mean, anything Christ did is basically has to be given out in the means of grace. I mean, they can get around any argument like that just by saying, well, it has to be given out in the means of grace.
Well,
frustrating.
Yeah, well, that's also how they would explain the issue of specifically of how people might not receive the work of Christ and why they might be lost. It that's really how you end up with the idea or allowing for an idea of a non-sovereign decree of God in the sense of salvation. You end up by saying, well, yeah, God did all these things, however, you still have to access these things through the sacraments, and that's where you end up running into some major issues as you have discovered yourself.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well,
thanks, Adam.
Thanks.
All right. God bless. Bye bye. 877-753-3341. Let's go over to the left coast and talk with James. Hi, James.
Hi, James. two questions for you to comment on the TNIV, mm-hmm. The gender neutral stuff, and just comment on that translation or the controversy that's going on. And then I was listening a few days ago to the White Horse Inn and Dr. Schuller's interview, and I was really blown away. I tell you, my heart went out to Dr. Schuller. Because I feel he was, late at night and he's old or something. But, boy, I tell you, when he couldn't, the things he said about the wrath of God and couldn't even preach it, that shocked me. Well, I don't know if it shocked me, but, I kind of know where he's at on some things.
Yeah,
anyway, comment
on
those two items, if you will, and I'll hang up.
Okay, well, thanks for calling, James.
Yeah.
I as far as the last one, my heart went out to Mike Horton, not to Robert Schuller. For those of you who haven't heard it, I don't know if they still have this going on, but last week sometime, if you made any donation, a dollar or whatever, to the White Horse Inn, you could download the tape of the program from the White Horse Inn from a number of years ago. I don't even remember how long ago it was. I remember I had gotten the tape way back then, and the very use of the term tape tells you something. I remember having been amazed listening to it then, but I was even more amazed now because I could put myself in the position of Mike Horton and the way that Schuller treated him and just went after him and this is terrible that you would ask me these difficult questions and all the rest of stuff. And it's like, what? Did you think you're gonna go on the air and these people aren't gonna ask you questions about what you've put in print? It was absolutely amazing. So that's still available, and I would recommend it to you. I put it on the blog so that people could take a look at that and listen to it. It is rather fascinating to hear that many years after it was recorded, of course. But I don't believe that Robert Schuller was that old of a man at that time to make a claim that, well, it's late at night and stuff like that. Oh, come on, you knew what you were getting into when you went in there, and you just anyways. So that was interesting. As far as TNIV goes. sadly, I'm going to have to disappoint a lot of folks here and say that I think the vast majority of that entire argument is, well, it's politics. Sorry, but it is. Do I support what the TNIV is doing? There's some real problem renderings, primarily in the book of Hebrews. But realize that pretty much any modern translation has, quote-unquote, gender-neutral translations in it. What's gender-neutral? If you're not aware of this, let me back up a second, or this isn't going to make any sense to you at all. In the languages from which the Bible is translated, the general cultural usage in the time of the writing was to utilize a masculine pronoun in the vast majority of instances. When you're simply making reference to someone, you would say he. You would not say she unless you had a specific female in mind. But a generic usage would be to use he. And, of course, when I grew up, that was the same in English, was it not? When you were making a generic reference, you would use the masculine pronoun he. Well, there has been, for better or for worse, a movement within the English language, originating primarily in Europe, but it certainly exists in the United States, to not go to a neutral rendering in the sense of it, a neutered rendering, but actually to trade off, to switch back and forth between he and she, which is, to me, just incredibly distracting. Just incredibly distracting. I've told the story before that I turned in the text to one of my books, to a publisher, who will remain nameless, and the manuscript came back, and I'm starting to read it, and all of a sudden I run across she. And immediately I stop and start looking for the antecedent. I start looking for, where did I refer to a woman? Why does it say she? And that's when I realized that they had randomly replaced the generic use of he with she throughout the text of the book. And I just simply circled everyone and I said, no, not in my work. This is, I don't agree that this is necessary. This is distracting. This is simply political correctness run amok. There's just no reason for this. And I struck them all out. So that is the idea of trying to be, you know, any type of politically correct emphasis to this stuff. I just go, sorry, not worth it. There's no reason for this. But there are passages where the masculine is used in the original, and yet the application is made to everyone. For example, when Paul talks about the Lord's Supper, he says, let a man examine himself in regards to the Lord's Supper. Well, doesn't that mean let everyone? Are women who partake, are our sisters in the Lord who partake the Lord's Supper, not under the teaching of the apostle that they are to examine themselves and have the exact same attitude that men have when they partake the Lord's Supper? Well, I would think that they would. And so the idea of a gender-neutral translation, or at least applying some level, because if you want to see a truly gender-neutral translation, go see the Oxford Monstrosity. That's what I call it. It came out in 95, the Oxford Monstrosity. It's based on the NRSV, but then, for example, you don't have Father God, you have Mother Father God. And you don't have the Son of God, you have the Child of God. That is gender neutrality taken to its absolute nth degree. All right? That's not what the TNIV is doing. It doesn't say Father, Mother, God. It doesn't say Jesus, the Son, the Child of God, and things like that. But there are places where, in addressing brothers, it becomes brothers and sisters. Well, they're not the first translation to do that. But especially when we get into the book of Hebrews and see when it gets into those passages where male and female roles are distinguished, or at least you could make the theological case that they're distinguished, that's where the real argument should be. Unfortunately, the real argument rarely gets to that point, at least as far as most people are concerned. Most of the time, the real argument is just, these people are evil because they want to do this, and those people are evil because they don't want us to do this. And it sadly, you end up having people lining up on both sides, and I wish the lines were not influenced by the fact that these major translations cost money. And there is literally millions, in fact, I think I'd be safe to say tens of millions and probably hundreds of millions of dollars at stake in regards to new translations of the Bible in English. It shouldn't be that way. We have enough. We don't need new ones. We don't need new translations of the Bible in English. All the money that's going into that stuff should be put into providing translations in foreign languages, and especially in languages that don't yet have complete or good or accurate translations of the Bible. But that's what's happening. But I've gone past the time of the break. I will continue the comments on the other side and continue taking your phone calls, 877-753-3341. We'll be right back.
A godly man is such a rarity today. So many stars, strong and true, quickly fall away.
Under the guise of tolerance, modern culture grants alternative lifestyle status to homosexuality. Even more disturbing, some within the church attempt to revise and distort Christian teaching on this behavior. In their book, The Same-Sex Controversy, James White and Jeff Neal write for all who want to better understand the Bible's teaching on the subject, explaining and defending the foundational Bible passages that deal with homosexuality, including Genesis, Leviticus, and Romans. Expanding on these scriptures, they refute the revisionist arguments, including the claim that Christians today need not adhere to the law. In a straightforward and loving manner, they appeal to those caught up in a homosexual lifestyle to repent and to return to God's plan for His people. The Same-Sex Controversy, Defending and Clarifying the Bible's Message About Homosexuality. Get your copy in the bookstore at aomin.org.
Alaska, the unspoiled land of nature and immensity. Both in its realities and its possibilities, Alaska can stir our hearts and minds like no other place on earth. Join us this summer for the 2005 Alpha and Omega Ministries Alaskan Cruise as we cruise the inside passage to the great land of Alaska with Dr. James White and Christian recording artist Steve Camp as they explore the great doctrine of sola scriptura. For our guests, the journey north is an odyssey of glorious landscapes and majestic wildlife as we sail on the luxury five-star Sun Princess by towering glaciers into some of the most remarkable points on Earth. All this, and at prices beginning at $624 per person, plus port taxes and fees, half the price of other offerings to Alaska with other groups. Contact us today at aomin.org or at 877-SOV-CRUISE.
Millions of petitioners from around the world are imploring Pope John Paul II to recognize the Virgin Mary as co-redeemer with Christ, elevating the topic of Roman Catholic views of Mary to national headlines and widespread discussion. In his book, Mary, Another Redeemer, James White sidesteps hostile rhetoric and cites directly from Roman Catholic sources to explore this volatile topic. He traces how Mary of the Bible, esteemed mother of the Lord, obedient servant, and chosen vessel of God, has become the immaculately conceived, bodily assumed Queen of Heaven, viewed as co-mediator with Christ and now recognized as co-redeemer by many in the Roman Catholic Church. Mary, Another Redeemer, is fresh insight into the woman the Bible calls blessed among women and an invitation to single-minded devotion to God's truth. You can order your copy of James White's book, Mary, Another Redeemer, at aomin.org.
This portion of The Dividing Line has been made possible by the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. The Apostle Paul spoke of the importance of solemnly testifying of the gospel of the grace of God. The proclamation of God's truth is the most important element of His worship in His church. The elders and people of the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church invite you to worship with them this coming Lord's Day. The morning Bible study begins at 9:30 a.m. and the worship service is at 10:45. Evening services are at 6:30 p.m. on Sunday and the Wednesday night prayer meeting is at 7. The Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church is located at 3805 North 12th Street in Phoenix. You can call for further information at 602-26-GRACE. If you're unable to attend, you can still participate with your computer and real audio at prbc.org, where the ministry extends around the world through the archives of sermons and Bible study lessons available 24 hours a day.
How the Pilgrim's Progress is not an easy way. It's a journey to the sun, day by day. But following Jesus is a walk of praise.
And welcome back to Dividing Line. There goes Steve Camp. We usher him out right as he gets that line every week. If you'd like to hear him finish that song, listen to his entire album. Anyway, commenting on the TNIV, I've written a set of articles for the CRI Journal on Bible translations, and I think folks could be a little bit surprised, because basically what I said was, you know what? There are a whole lot more good translations than there are bad translations. And what we really need, gets people going is that for some reason we have accepted this idea that we should only have one. That we as English-speaking people, you need to grab hold of your one and defend it at all costs. So anybody else uses another translation, you're evil, horrible, and bad, and you question the person's theology and spirituality and everything else. And actually, I think you should have, if you're not going to take the time to learn the original languages, which it's easier to do so today than it's ever been in the past, but if you're not going to do that, then you're going to want to have available to you multiple translations. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have a base translation that you memorize from that maybe is the one that's primarily used at your church or something like that, and certainly in a church, it's good to have a consistent translation so people know what to expect. And so that you can maybe even have public readings and so on and so forth. And that's fine. But in your personal study, if you're not going to be studying the original languages, then utilize the resources that are available to you. I'm watching what's going on the channel right now. And it's interesting to watch what people are saying. Everybody's saying, I'm NASB, I'm ESV. Well, I've many times said the ESV is the NASB minus semicolons, and there's a lot of truth to that, unfortunately. CEV, blah. The problem is, comparing the NASB and the ESV isn't going to do you a lot of good. Why? Because there is a spectrum of translation. And on the right-hand side of the spectrum of translation, you have formal equivalency. The most literal translations, and literal I mean by the form of the language, not necessarily the meaning of the language, because a literal rendering of the words may not result in an actual literal rendering of the meaning. If you literally render an idiom in the original language into the receptor language, which for us is English, then you're actually not translating the meaning. When you encounter an idiom like to have in the womb, when you say such and such a woman has in the womb, that's a literal translation. That's a formal equivalency translation, but that's not what it means. It means she's pregnant. And so that's one of the issues that comes up here, is you have a spectrum from the most woodenly literal on the right to the dynamic or functional on the left. And what I did in these articles is I went back to Luke 9:44, and I put, as I recall, 11, or was it 12, translations And I gave their rendering of that passage and then placed them on a spectrum as to where they fell. And it pretty well tracked with where you'd normally put those in the spectrum of translations. If you have as your base translation, as your foundational translation, a more formal equivalency translation, which I would recommend for preaching and teaching. How many times do you hear a pastor? He will read from the King James, New King James, New American Standard, those more formal equivalency translations, and then he will say, and the Greek here could be understood, and then he'll give a very, what would be called a functional or dynamic translation. And no one has a, well, not most people, I guess King James only advocates have a problem with it, but most people don't have a problem when the pastor does that. And one of the things I address is, where should interpretation take place? And I think it should take place right where it does take place, right there, in the proclamation of the word, the elders speaking to the church, so on and so forth. But going back to your own personal study, if you get, if you just cluster all the translations you're using down on one side of the spectrum, comparing them isn't going to do you any good. The only way you can get really any more light upon the passage is to have some translations that are farther down the spectrum than the one you're utilizing. And that especially is going to help you to recognize idiomatic phrases, things that, that maybe you thought you knew what it meant traditionally, but a more functional or dynamic translation might give you an insight that you hadn't had before. But one last thing here. The problem, you know, I mentioned earlier, the problem that we have is we have so many today. We don't need any more, but there's more that will be coming out. Why have all these translations appeared over the past 10 years, 15 years? Real simple. Money. Money. When Thomas Nelson became a public entity and they bought up Word, they forced everybody to put their study Bibles in the New King James Version because they owned the copyright to the New King James Version. And so if you're going to have a study Bible, it's going to be put out by a company that was owned eventually in one way or another by Thomas Nelson. If you want to have your study Bible in the NIV or in the New American Standard, then you would have to pay royalties to those other publishers for the use of their translation. And Thomas L. said, we're not going to do that, so you're going to put it in ours. And so the Geneva Study Bible originally came out in New King James Version. That's not what it was written for. The MacArthur Study Bible, John MacArthur doesn't use the New King James Version, but it came out in the New King James Version rather than the New American Standard, which is what he's used. So why have all these, the Holman Christian Standard Bible and the ESV and all these translations that have come out are owned by particular large publishing companies. And so now what they can do is they can have their study Bibles, and be honest with you, no one's asked me on this program, but I'll tell you anyways, I don't like study Bibles. I think study Bibles are a waste of money and leather, to be honest with you. But they sell millions and millions and millions of dollars worth. And so now these companies can do their own study Bibles, and they can do them in their own translation without then having to take a portion of their profit and ship it off to somebody else. See? So that's why they've all come into existence. That's why the New Living Translation and all these, you'll notice they're from different companies, and millions of dollars have been poured into the promotion of these. I mean, man, if you want to get free Bibles, it's real easy. Be a seminary student or go to a Bible college, because, man, I've seen them passing out freebie everything. You know, when the NET came out and the NLT and the ESV, and they're just, you know, you could collect all of them that way. It'd be a nice cheap way to do so, I suppose. And so that there's good and there's bad. We need to take the good, utilize the good translations, compare them with one another, gain the profit that can come from that, but recognizing that, sadly, a lot of what you read is not motivated by, and it's not written by or motivated by completely pure motives, shall we say. There's politics involved. And if you happen to work for a particular company as a scholar and you worked on a particular translation, well, you know, then when somebody's coming out with another translation that could cut into your profits, then sadly, Bible translation is an area where there's a whole lot more heat than there is light very frequently. And a whole lot more dedication to tradition. I mean, not even talking about the King James only thing. The King James only attitude can extend beyond the King James only controversy to where people use the same type of attitude toward whatever they've become accustomed to. We have a whole generation coming up now that have known almost nothing but the NIV. And so they look at these others as like, oh, that's weird. You know, that's odd. And when you've heard God speak through the word in a particular cadence, in a particular way, any new translation, unless it's very similar to the one you have, is going to seem different. But there's reasons for that, and unfortunately we tend to allow far too much emotion and sectarianism to enter into the Bible translation area than we probably should. And that ends up causing a problem. 877-753-3341. Spent a lot more time on that than I expected to. Let's talk with Marcus. Hi, Marcus.
Yes, hello.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine. How are you?
Doing good.
I had a question about your about Calvinism in general. I get the feeling that I have been misinformed.
Okay.
To say the least. My question is specifically about how does human will relate to the salvation and sovereignty of God, and from the Calvinist point of view.
Okay. Well, it might help me a little bit if I knew what you feel you may have been misinformed about.
Well, like, for example, it's always been sort of taught to me that Calvinism, the belief is that you can believe all you want, you know, do, you know, as much good as, you know, just obey the Bible all the way, even if you never did anything wrong. If you weren't predestined for salvation, you missed it.
Ah, wow. Okay, well, I can certainly understand why there's a bit of confusion there. Obviously, from a Calvinistic perspective, we would not believe that anyone who would do those things, a person who would actually truly believe or truly desire to do what's pleasing to God, we don't believe that anyone who remains in their sins, who has not been regenerated, would have a desire to do those things in the first place. Now, obviously, there is false religion in the world. There are people who do a lot of religious things, but they do not do those religious things for the glory of God. They do those religious things to bring about their own betterment or somehow to obtain something from God, whatever else it might be. There's a lot of false religion, and we recognize that men hide behind false religion to avoid dealing with the true God. I mean, you know, there are Mormons out there that are very moral people, but they're worshiping a God who is actually just like they are, just farther down the line of exaltation. And so that aside, Calvinists believe that man has a will. Calvinists believe that man makes decisions. We just don't believe, in fact, I mentioned this last week on the program, but it sort of got run over by something else that happened in the program. Calvinists believe in liberty. They just don't believe in the liberty of indifference. That is, we believe that man exists, the creature of God exists, under the control of and under the conditioning of and under the overarching umbrella of God's sovereign decree. God's decree determines what man is, what man can do, what man's life is going to be like, etc., etc. God is sovereign in all these things, and yet we as creatures are given certain capacities, and these capacities are used by God in bringing about his perfect will. And so the idea that there could be someone who repents, who feels true sorrow for their sin, who clings to Christ and prays to Christ and wants Christ and all these other things, and yet is going to end up appearing before God, and God says, hey, forget you, you weren't elect, goes completely against what Calvinists teach for a simple reason. We don't believe that a man who is dead in sin has the capacity to do any of those things in the first place.
Exactly. I mean, that definitely makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, we in fact, that's the whole problem. The whole reason that salvation has to be completely the work of God is because that man who is dead in sin has no desire for the things of God. He's according to the flesh, you know, those things of God are foolishness to that person. That's what the Bible tells us. And so the idea that such a person could be clinging to Christ and then be rejected, not a chance on earth. I've heard the same misrepresentation, but that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, that's why I'm listening to you over the past couple of weeks, it's occurred to me that I didn't understand what Calvinists believe.
Right, yeah. Sadly, despite what some people say, we do not control the media. We do not. I don't know if you heard the program I was on with Chuck Christmeyer, but he tended to feel that the Bible Belt is filled with Calvinists or something like that. I'm just like, wow, okay, that's interesting. That's just not the case, and so unfortunately, we frequently have to address these issues because if we don't talk about them. Everybody else really has a much wider ability to communicate misapprehensions than we have to correct them. And so sometimes we have to do that. But have you had a chance to look at The Potter's Freedom yet?
I've been wanting to, but I haven't been able to afford the book. I couldn't find it in the library here.
Oh, man. Well, we need to get somebody to donate one to the library there and track that. I mean, you're in... California. I mean,
I haven't looked like in Oakland or anything like that. I bet I could find it in Oakland.
Well,
or San Francisco.
All right. Well, if you can't find one, then get in touch with us and we'll get you one. Something tells me that there's folks listening right now that would say, "Hey, I'll definitely cover a copy of The Potter's Freedom for Marcus out there in California." So if you can't track one down there in Oakland, let us know and we'll definitely get you one. Okay.
Okay.
All righty?
Okay.
Thanks, Marcus. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right. God bless. Bye-bye. 877-753-3341 is the phone number. I was going to ask a question there, and because I'm always fascinated. How does anybody know about this program? It is always fascinating to me when I go traveling. I'm sure I'll probably run into some folks this weekend in North Carolina. Yes, even in North Carolina. I just saw somebody in channel say, "I'll cover it." I knew that we would be able to find that. And they listened to The Dividing Line, and I don't know how they ever heard about it. You know, I mean, it's one thing when we were on the radio, but we're not on the radio. That's an expenditure of money that's beyond what it was worth, because when we were on the radio, all of our calls came from outside where the radio station reached. It was completely based upon the internet anyways, and so we've never sought to go back there. And I know there are others, you know, that have a much wider swath of influence, but it is absolutely fascinating how people end up catching this program. It just it really, really is neat. I it'd be very interesting to have a convention of everyone who listens to The Dividing Line. What an odd group that would be. We were talking in channel about the fact that when we all get together, it's a little bit odd for us because we actually have to talk. We've frequently said what we need to do is set up a wireless network, and then we could all sit around with our laptops, and we'd feel much more comfortable chatting to each other and playing our sound files at each other than actually having to interact and look in people's eyes and all that kind of stuff. That would be very, very strange, very odd indeed. But anyway, I truly appreciate the listeners to this program who, I mean, you're making an effort to listen. You had to fire up a program. You had to click on a link. You're making an effort to listen, and therefore, we try to make it as interesting for you as we can. I got to admit, I don't know of too many other programs like this where we address the broad range of topics that we address from the perspective that we address it at. And I recognize that some people would say, well, you know, you're not balanced because you always talk about Calvinism. Well, you know what? Like I said, that's not how it is at my church. But when you're involved in apologetics, I really, really honestly, yeah, we are equal time. I really honestly would suggest that an apologetic methodology is determined by one's systematic theology. And so to do apologetics, we answer questions and we approach apologetics differently than almost everybody else. And there has to be an explanation as to why that is. Why won't we use certain, what the world would consider to be effective methodologies? Because we don't believe that it's consistent with the proclamation of the gospel and what the gospel is. I mean, if you really believe what we believe about how God saves people, then you're not going to try to trick them into salvation, are you? You're not going to try to make appeals to men in such a way that dishonors God and dishonors the gospel. We're not going to try to get them in using one methodology. And then once we've got them hooked, you know, you got them signed, you know, they signed on the line. And now that they've signed on the line, now we've got to start deconstructing what we said before. We've got to start taking it apart and correcting it. Yeah, we know that we sort of indicated that, you know, you were making the decision here, you know, and but in reality, what we meant was this. You know, I just don't think that's how you do it. I don't think that that's honoring and glorifying to God to, in essence, have to backtrack after you trick somebody into the faith and say, well, you know, I know we said this, but what we really meant was this, as was just mentioned in channel, pragmatism. You know, we can't do that. There is an inconsistency there. I can't be telling somebody about the truth and then I'm being inconsistent with the truth myself. There's something internally to me that will not allow me to do that. And that's why we are the size we are. That's why you don't hear us yelling and screaming about money all the time. It's not because we have a lot of it coming in. We don't have some big, rich person that has just dumped a bunch of... It just doesn't happen. That's not us. That's why we're different. You know, we see ourselves as an assistant to the church in assisting pastors, and we are not the church. We will not act like the church. We will not do anything like that. And it all goes back to what we believe theologically. That's not an imbalance. It's just due to the fact that, you know, when the society and the church around you is out of balance and you're trying to stay in balance, it looks like you're the one that's out of balance. Well, anyways, I hope that made some sense to you. We will be back, Lord willing, unless I have a flight problem, for the Dividing Line Tuesday. I get back on Monday. So if we're going to see you this weekend in North Carolina, drive carefully. Look forward to seeing you then. If not, we'll see you next week on the Dividing Line. God bless.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.